Chapter 3. Nisimé Carpel. A Light in Endless Darkness. The Pontius. I shot one meaningful glance at Betancourt to stay his hand, then calmly walked past him, slid down the ladder frame, and approached Carpel. The custodians closed in around me, but at a distance. "Hi, custodian," I nodded. He fixed me with a steady but wary gaze, and licked spittle off his thin lips. "You will be detained until—" "No," I replied. "I am an inquisitor of the God Emperor of Mankind, Ordo Xenos. I will cooperate in any investigation you bring to bear here, fully and completely. But you will not and cannot detain me. Do you understand?"
"An inquisitor?"
"Do you understand?" I repeated. I wasn't using my will at all. Not yet. I would if I had to, but I trusted that he would have the sense to listen to me first. He could make things awkward for me, but I could make things intolerable for him. He seemed to soften a little. As I had judged, part of his rage came from shock at this incident, shock that so many planetary nobles in his care had suffered. He was looking for somewhere to pin the blame. Now he had to temper that with the idea that he was dealing with a member of the most feared institution in the Imperium.
"Thousands are dead," he began, a tremor in his voice. "This desecration, the highborn of hubris, violated by a
murderer, a follower of darkness, a man who, thanks to me, lies dead now under a plastic sheet on the upper landing platform. I mourn the great loss hubris has suffered tonight, High Custodian, and I wish I had been able to prevent it. But if I had not been here at all to raise the alarm, well, imagine the tragedy you would be dealing with then." I let that sink in. "Not just this processional, but all the hibernation tombs. Who knows what Eichlone might have wrought? Who knows what his overall ambition was?"
"Eichlone? The recidivist?"
"He did this, High Custodian."
"You will brief me on this entire event.
Let me prepare a report and bring it to you. You may have answers for me, too. I will signal you in a few hours for an appointment to meet. I think you have plenty to deal with right now." We made our way out. Betancourt presented the junior custodians with a formal register of evidence to be stored for my inspection. The list included the casket and the bodies of Eichlone and his men. None would be tampered with, or even searched until I had looked at them. The gunman I had subdued in the cryogenerator chamber, the only one left alive, would be incarcerated pending my interrogation. Betancourt made these requirements abundantly clear. We took Vibben with us. Amos was too frail, so Betancourt and I handled the plastic-shrouded form on the gurney. We left Processional 212 by the main vault doors into the biting cold of the constant night, and carried Vibben down towards a waiting ice car, taking her through the hundreds of rows of corpses the custodians were laying out on the frozen ground. My band and I had deployed onto Hubris the moment we arrived. Such was the urgency of our chase. Now it looked like we would remain here for at least a week, longer if Carpel proved difficult. As we rode the ice car back to the landing cross, I had Amos make arrangements for our stay. During dormant on Hubris, while 99% of the planetary population hibernates, one location remains active. The custodians and the techno-magi weather out the long, bitter darkness in a place called the Sun Dome. 50 kilometers from the vast expanse of the dormant plains, where the hibernation tombs stand in rows, the Sun Dome sits like a dark grey blister in the ongoing winter night. It is home to 59,000 people, just a town compared with the great empty cities that slumber below the horizon line, waiting for thaw to bring their populations back. I stared out at the Sun Dome as the gun cutter swept us in towards it through wind-blown storms of ice. Small red marker lights winked on the surfaces of the dome and from the masts jutting from the apex. Betancourt flew, silent, concentrating. He had removed his tight-fitting gloves so that the intricate Glavian circuitry set like silver inlays into his palms and fingertips could engage with the cutter's system directly via the control stick. Amos sat in a rear cabin, poring over manuscripts and data slates. Two independent multitask servitors waited for commands in the crew bay. The ship had five in all.
two were limbless combat units slaved directly to the gun pods, and the other, the chief servitor, a high-spec model we called Euclid, never left his duties in the engine room. Loink, my astropath, slumbered in his chamber, linked to the Vox and Pict systems, awaiting a summons. Vibben lay shrouded on the cot in her room. Betancourt swung the cutter down towards the dome. After an exchange of telemetry, a wide blast shutter opened in the side of the dome. The light that shone out was almost unbearably bright. Betancourt engaged the cockpit glare shields and flew us into the landing bay. The inside surface of the vast dome was mirrored. A plasma-effect sun globe burned high in the roof of the dome, bathing the town below in fierce white light. The town itself, spread out beneath us, seemed to be made of glass. We sat down in the wide bay, a 20-hectare metal platform that overlooked the town. The surface of the platform gleamed almost white in the reflected glare. Heavy monotask servitors trundled out and towed us into a landing silo off the main pad, where pit servitors moved in to attach fuel lines and begin fundamental servicing. Betancourt didn't want anybody or anything touching the gun cutter, so he ordered Modo and Nilquit, our two independent servitors, to take over the tasks and send the locals away. I could hear them moving around the hull, servos whirring, hydraulics hissing, exchanging machine code data bursts with each other, or with Euclid in the drive chamber. Amos offered to find accommodation for us in the town itself, but I decided a landing berth was all we needed. The gun cutter was large enough to provide ample facilities for our stay. We often spent weeks or months living aboard it. I went to Loing's small cabin under the cockpit deck and roused him. He hadn't been with me long. My previous astropath had been killed trying to translate a warp cipher 6 weeks before. Loing was a young man, with a fleshy, unhealthy bulk hanging from a thin, skeletal frame. His body already deteriorating from the demands of a psyker's life. Greasy implant plugs dotted his shaved skull and lined his forearms like short spines. As he came to the door, some of these plugs trailed wires, each marked with parchment labels, which led back to the communications main box above his cradle. Thousands of cables spilled or dangled around his tiny cabin, but he instinctively knew what each one did and could set and adjust plugins at a moment's notice. The room reeked of sweat and incense. "Master," he said. His mouth was a wet pink slit, and he had one lazy, half-hooded eye that gave him a superior air, quite belying his actual timidity. "Please send a message for me, Loink, to the Regal Aquitaine." The Regal was a rogue trader we had employed to convey the gun cutter and ourselves to Hubris. His vessel awaited us in orbit now, ready to provide further warp passage. "Give Trademaster Gulquin my respects and tell him we are staying for now. He can be on his way. There's no point in him waiting. We could be here for a week or more. The usual form, polite. Tell him I thank him for his service and hope we may meet again." Loink nodded.
"I will do it at once."
"Then I'd like you to perform some other tasks. Contact the main Astropathicus enclave here on Hubris and request a full transcript of off-world traffic for the past 6 weeks. Also any record of unlicensed traffic, individuals using their own astropaths. Whatever they can make available, and a little threat that it is an Inquisitor acquiring this data wouldn't hurt. They don't want to find themselves caught up in a major Inquisition for withholding information." He nodded again.
"Will you be requiring an auto-seance?"
"Not yet, but I will eventually. I will give you time to prepare."
"Will that be all, Master?"
I turned to go. "Yes, Loink."
"Master?"
He paused.
"Is it true that the female Vibben is dead?"
"Yes, Loink."
"Ah, I thought it was quiet."
He closed the door. The comment wasn't as callous as it sounded. I knew what he meant, though my own psychic abilities were nascent and undeveloped next to his. Laris Vibben was a latent psyker, and while she had been with us, there had been a constant background sound, almost subliminal, broadcast unconsciously by her young, eager mind. I found Betancourt outside, standing under the shadow of one of the gun cutter's stubby wings. He was gazing at the ground, smoking a low-leaf tube. I didn't approve of narcotics, but I let it go. He'd cleaned himself up these past few years. When I'd first met him, he had been an obscure user.
damned bright place," he muttered, wincing out at the abominable glare.
"A typical overreaction. They have 11 months of pitch dark, so they like their habitat to an excessive degree."
"Do they have a night cycle?"
"I don't believe so."
"No wonder they're so messed up. Extreme light, extreme dark, extreme mindsets. Their body clocks and natural rhythms must be all over the place."
I nodded. Outside, I had begun to be disarmed by the notion that the night was never going to end. Now I had the same feelings about this constant noon. In his brief, Amos had said the world was called Hubris because after spending 70 standard years getting here aboard their Ark fleet, the original colonists had found the surveys had been incorrect. Instead of enjoying a regular orbit, the world they had selected pursued this extreme pattern of darkness and light. They'd settled anyway, co-opting the cryogenerational methods that had got them here as part of their culture. A mistake, in my view. But I wasn't here to offer a cultural critique. "Notice anything?" I asked Betancourt. He made a casual gesture around the landing platform.
"They don't get many visitors in this season. Trade's all but dead. The world's on tick-over."
"Which is why Eichlone thought it vulnerable."
"Yes. Most of the ships here are local. Trans-atmospheric. Some are for the custodian's use. The others are simply berthed up over dormant. I make 3 non-locals, aside from us. 2 trader launches and a private cutter."
"Ask around. See if you can find out who they belong to and what their business is."
"Sure thing."
"Eichlone's pinnace, the one you shot down. Did it come from here?" He took a suck on his narc tube and shook his head.
"Either came from orbit or up from some private location. Loewing picked up its transmissions to Eichlone."
"I'll ask to see those. But it could have come from orbit. Eichlone may have a starship up there."
"Don't worry. I already thought to look. If there was one there, it's gone. And it made no signals."
"I'd like to know how that bastard got here, and how he was intending to leave again."
"I'll find that out,"
said Betancourt, crushing the tube stud under his heel. He meant it.
"What about Vibben?"
he asked. "Do you know what her wishes were?" "She never mentioned anything to me. Did she want her remains sent back to Tornish for burial?"
"You'd do that."
"If that was what she wanted. Is it?"
"I don't know, Eisenhorn. She never told me either."
"Take a look through her effects. See if she left any testament or instructions. Can you do that?"
"I'd like to do that,"
he said. I was tired by then. I spent another hour with Amos in his cramped, data-slate-filled room, preparing a report for Karpel. I set out the basic details, reserving anything I felt he didn't need to know. I accounted for my actions. I made Amos check them against local law to prepare myself in case Karpel raised a prosecution. I wasn't unduly worried about him, and in truth I was bulletproof against local legislation, but I wanted to check anyway. An Amalathian prides himself on working with the structures of Imperial society, not above or beyond them, or through them, as a monodominant might. I wanted Karpel and the senior officials of Hubris on my side, helping my investigation. When my report was complete, I retired to my room. I paused by Vibben's door, went in, and gently placed the Scipio naval pistol between her hands on her chest, folding the shroud back afterwards. It was hers. It had done its work. It deserved to be laid to rest with her. For the first time in 6 years, I did not dream about Eichlone. I dreamed of a blinding darkness, then a light that refused to go away. There was something dark about the light. Nonsense, I know, but that was how it felt, like a revelation that actually carried some grimmer, more profound truth. There were flashes like lightning around the edges of my dream's horizon. I saw a handsome, blank-eyed male, not blank-eyed like one of Eichlone's drones, but vacant, like an immense starless distance. He smiled at me. At that time in my life, I had no idea who he was. I went to see Karpel at noon the next day. It was always noon in the Sun Dome, but this was real noon by the clock. By then, Loewing, Amos, and Betancourt had all dredged up new information for me. I shaved and dressed in black linen, with high boots and a formal jacket of scaled brown hide. I wore my inquisitorial rosette at my throat. I intended to show Carpel I meant business. Amos and I descended from the landing platform superstructure by caged elevator and found yellow-robed custodians waiting to escort us. Despite the rancid white light all around, they still held ignited light poles. We made short, hard shadows on the dry rockcrete of the concourse as we crossed to an open limousine. It was a massive chrome-grilled beast with pennants bearing the hubris crest fluttering on its cowling. There were four rows of overstuffed leather benches behind the center-set driver's cockpit. We hummed through the streets on eight fat wheels. The boulevards were wide and, needless to say, bright. To either hand, glass-fronted buildings rose towards the blazing plasma sun globe high above, like flowers seeking the light. Every 30 meters along every street, chemical lamps on ornate posts strained to add their own light to the brilliance. Traffic was sparse, and there were at most a few thousand pedestrians on the streets. I noticed most wore yellow silk sashes, and that garlands of yellow flowers decorated every lamp post. "The flowers?" I asked. "From the hydroponic farms on East Dome 7," one of the custodians told me, signifying. "Morning."
"Same as the sashes," Amos whispered in confidence. "What happened last night is a major tragedy for this world. Yellow is their holy color. I believe the local religion is a solar belief."
"The sun as emperor?"
"Common enough. Extreme here, for obvious reasons."
The custodial hall was a glass spire close to the town center, a solar disk overlaid with the double-headed eagle of the Imperium decorating its upper faces. Nearby was the local chapel of the Ecclesiarchy, and several buildings given over to the Imperial Administratum. It amused me to see they were all built of black stone and virtually windowless. Those Imperial servants stationed here obviously had as little truck with me with the constant light. We drew in under a glass portico and were escorted into the main hall. It was seething with people, most of them custodians in yellow robes, some local officials and techno-magi, some clerks and servitors. The hall itself was of the scale of an imperial chapel, but raised in yellow-stained glass on a frame of black cast iron. The air was full of golden light shafting down through the glass. The carpet was vast, black, with a sun disk woven into its center.
"Inquisitor Eisenhorn," declared one of my escorts through a vox hailer.
The hall fell silent, and all turned to watch us approach. High custodian Carpel sat in a hovering lifter throne with gilt decorations. A burning chemical light was mounted above the head of the floating chair. He swung in through the parting crowd towards me. "High custodian," I said with a dutiful nod.
"They are all dead," he informed me. "All 12,142. Processional 212 is dead. None survived the trauma."
"Hubris has my sincere sympathies, High Custodian." The hall exploded in pandemonium, voices screeching and shouting and clamouring.
"Your sympathies? Your damned sympathies?" Carpel screamed above the roar. "A great part of our ruling elite die in one night, and we have your sympathies to console us?" "That is all I can offer, High Custodian." I could feel Amos shivering at my side, making aimless notes on his wrist slate about custom and clothing and language forms, anything to take his mind from the confrontation.
"That's hardly good enough,"
spat a young man nearby. He was a local noble, young and firm enough, but his skin had a dreadful, sweaty pallor, and custodians supported him as he stumbled forward. "Who are you?" I asked.
"Vernal Maypel, heir lord of the Dalawen Cantons."
If he expected me to fall to my knees in supplication, he was in for a disappointment.
"Because of the gravity of this event, we have roused some of our high-born early from their dormancy," Carpel said. "Liege Maypel's brother and two of his wives died in processional 212.
So the pallor was revival sickness. I noticed that 50 or more of the congregation present were similarly wasted and ill. I turned to Maypel. "Liege, I repeat, you have my condolences." Maypel exploded with rage.
Your arrogance astounds me, Offwelder. You bring this monster to our world, battle with him through our most sacred sanctums, a private war that slaughters our best, and you—
Wait! I used my will. I didn't care. Maypel stopped as if stunned, and the vast hall rang silent. I came here to save you and deny Eiklone's plans. But for the efforts of myself and my companions, he might have destroyed more than one of your hibernation tombs. I broke none of your laws. I was careful to preserve your codes in pursuit of my work. What do you mean I brought this monster here?
We have made inquiries, answered an elderly noblewoman nearby.
Like Maypel, she was ailing with revival sickness and sat hunched on a litter carried by slaved servitors. What inquiries, madam?
This long feud with the murderer Eiklone. 5 years, is it now?
6, lady.
6, then. You have hounded him here, driven him, brought him, as Liege Maypel said.
How?
We registered no off-world ship these past 20 days, except yours, Eisenhorn, Kappel said, reviewing a data slate. The Regal Aquitaine. That ship must have brought him as it brought you, to finish your war here and damn our lives. Did you choose Hubris because it was quiet, out of the way, a place where you might finish your feud undisturbed in the long dark?
I was angry by now. I concentrated to control my rage. Amos? Beside me, he was muttering.
And what silicate dyes do they use in their stained glass manufacture? Is the structure armored? The supports are early Imperial Gothic in style, but—
Amos, the report!
He started and handed me a data slate from his leather case.
Read this, Carpo. Read it thoroughly. I pushed it at him, then snatched it away as he reached for it. Or should I read it aloud to all here assembled? Should I explain how I came here at the last minute, when I learned Eiklone was moving to Hubris? That I learned that only by astropathic decryption of a cipher message sent by Eiklone 2 months ago? A cipher that killed my astropath in his efforts to translate it?
Inquisitor, I—
Carpel began. I held up the data slate report for them all, thumbing the stud that scrolled the words across the screen. And what about this? The evidence that Eiklone has been planning a move against your world for almost a year. And this. Gathered this last night. That an unregistered starship moved in and out of your orbit to deliver Eiklone 3 days ago, unnoticed by your planetary overwatch and the custodian Guardians. Or the itemized stream of astropathic communication that your local enclave noticed but didn't bother to source or translate? I tossed the slate into Carpel's lap. Hundreds of eyes stared at me in shocked silence.
You are wide open. He exploited you. Don't blame me for anything except being too late to stop him. As I said, you have my sincere condolences.
And next time you choose to confront an Imperial Inquisitor, I added, you may want to be more respectful. I'm excusing a lot because I recognize the trauma and loss you have suffered. But my patience isn't limitless. Unlike my authority. I turned to Carpel. Now, High Custodian, can we talk in private, as I think I requested? We followed Carpel's floating throne into a side annex, leaving a hall full of murmuring, shocked voices behind us. Only one of his men accompanied us, a tall, blond fellow in a dark brown uniform I didn't recognize. A bodyguard, I presumed. Carpel set his throne down on the carpet and raised a remote wand that tinted the glass plates of the room at a touch. Reasonable light levels at last. From that alone I knew Carpel was taking me seriously. He waved me to a seat opposite. Amos lurked in the shadows behind me. The man in brown stood by the windows, watching.
What happens now? Carpel asked.
I expect your full cooperation as I extend my investigation.
But the matter is over, said the man in brown.
I kept my gaze on Carpel. I want your consent for me to continue, as well as your full cooperation. Eiklone may be dead, but he was just the blade point of a long and still dangerous weapon.
What are you talking about?
The man in brown snapped. Still, I did not look at him. Staring at Karpel, I said, "If he speaks again without me knowing who he is, I will throw him out of the window, and I won't open it first." "This is Chesna Fischig of the Adeptus Arbites. I wanted him present." Now I looked at the man in brown. He was a heavy-set brute with a loop of shiny pink scar tissue under one milky eye. I'd taken him to be a young man with his clean skin and blonde hair, but now I studied him, I saw he was at least my age. "Chesna," I nodded.
"Inquisitor," he returned. "My question stands."
I sat back in my chair. Merdin Eichlone was a facilitator. A brilliant, devious man, one of the most dangerous I have ever hunted. Sometimes to hunt down your prey is to finish his evil. I'm sure you have experience of that.
You called him a facilitator.
That was where his danger lay. He believed he could serve his obscene masters best by offering his considerable skills to cults and sects that needed them. He had no true allegiances. He worked to facilitate the grand schemes of others. What he was doing here on Hubris was to advance and develop someone else's plans. Now he is dead, and his scheme thwarted. We may be thankful, but my task is not done. I must work back from Eichlone, his men, from any clue he left, and dig my way into whatever greater secret darkness was employing him.
"And for this you want the cooperation of the people of Hubris?" asked Karpel.
"The people? The authorities? You? Everyone. This is the Emperor's work. Will you shrink from it?"
"No, sir, I will not," snapped Karpel.
"Excellent." Karpel tossed a gold solar form badge to me. It was heavy and old, mounted on a pad of black leather.
"This will give you authority, my authority. Conduct your work thoroughly and quickly. I ask two things in return."
"And they are?"
"You report all findings to me, and you allow the Chastener to accompany you."
"I work my own way. Fischig can open doors and voice boxes here in the Sun Dome that even that badge may not.
Consider him a local guide."
"And your ears and eyes," I thought. But I knew he was under immense pressure from the nobility to produce results, so I said, "I will be grateful for his assistance."
"Where first?"
Fischig asked. Down to business at once, a hungry look on his face. They want blood, I realized. They want someone to punish for the deaths, someone they could say they caught, or at least helped to catch. They want to share in whatever successes I have so that they can look good when the rest of their population wakes up to this disaster in a few months' time. I couldn't blame them. "First," I said, "the mortuary." Eichlone looked as if he was asleep. His head had been wrapped in an almost comical plastic bonnet to contain the wound I had dealt him. Framed in the plastic, his face was tranquil, with just a slight bruising around the lips. He lay on a stone plinth in the chill of the morgue below RBT's Mortuary 1. His brethren lay on numbered plinths around him, those that had been recovered more or less intact. There were labelled bins of mostly liquescent material against the back wall, the remains of those that Betancourt had slaughtered with the cutter's cannons. The air in the underground vault was lit cold blue, and frost-covered circulators pumped in sub-zero air directly from the ice desert outside the Sun Dome. Fischig had provided us all with heat gowns for the visit. I was impressed by what I saw. Both the dutiful care and attention that had been used to sequester and store the bodies, and by the fact that no one had touched them, according to my instructions. It seems a simple command to give, but I have lost count of the times that over-eager death priests or surgeons have begun autopsies before I arrived. The mortician superintendent was a haggard woman in her 60s called Tutrone. She attended us in red plastic scrubs worn over an old and threadbare heat gown. Mortress Tutrone had a bionic implant in one eye socket, and blades and bone-saw manipulators of gleaming surgical steel built into her right hand. "I have done as you instructed," she told me as she led us down the spiral steps into the cold vault. "But it is irregular. Rules state I must begin examinations, prelim examinations at least, as soon as possible." "I thank you for your diligence, Mortress. I will be done quickly. Then you can follow protocol." Pulling on surgical gloves, I moved through the lines of dead. There were nearly 20 of them, dictating observations to Amos. There was virtually nothing to be learned from the men. Some, I gauged from build and coloration, to be off-worlders, but they had no documents, no surgical identifiers, no clue whatsoever about their origins or identities. Even their clothing was blank. Manufacturing tags and labels had been torn or burned off. I could begin a forensic investigation to identify the source of the clothing, but that would be a massive waste of resources. On two of them, I found fresh scars that suggested subcutaneous ident markers had been surgically removed. Ident marking was not a local practice, so that at least suggested off-world. But where? Hundreds of Imperial planets routinely used such devices, and their placing and use was pretty standard. I had carried one myself for a few years as a child, before the Black Ship selected me, and it was dug out. One of the corpses had a curious scarring on the forearms, not deep, but thorough, searing the epidermis.
"Someone has used a melter torch to remove gang tattoos," Amos said.
He was right. Again, it was tantalizingly incomplete. I looked at Eiklone, where I thought my best bet lay. With the mortress's help, I cut away his clothes, all of which were as anonymous as his followers' garb. We turned his naked corpse, looking for, well, anything.
"There," Fischig said, leaning in, "a brand mark above the left buttock.
The Seraph of Loacus. An old chaos mark. Eiklone had it done to honour his then masters 20 years ago. A previous cult. A previous employer. Nothing to do with this." Fischig looked at me curiously.
"You know the details of his naked flesh?"
"I have sources," I replied. I didn't want to have to tell the tale. Imanda, one of my first companions, brilliant, beautiful, and bold. She had found that detail out for me. She had been in an asylum now for 5 years. The last report I had received said she had eaten away her own fingers.
"But he marks himself," Fischig added. "With each new cult he involves himself in, he carries their mark to show his allegiance."
The man had a point, damn him. We looked. At least 6 laser scars on his body seemed likely to have been previous cult marks, burned off after he left those associations. Behind his left ear, a skin inlay of silver was worked in the form of the Bubo Chaotica.
"This?"
asked Teutrone, shaving the hair aside with her finger blades to reveal it.
"Old, as before."
I stepped back from the body and thought hard. When I'd killed him, he had been reaching for something on his belt, or so it had seemed to me. His effects? They were laid out on a metal tray nearby. His las pistol, a compact vox device, a pearl inlaid box containing 6 obscura tubes and an igniter, a credit tile, spare cells for the gun, a plastic key, and the belt, with 4 buttoned pouches. I opened them one by one, some local coins, a miniature las knife, 3 bars of high-calorie rations, a steel toothpick, more obscura, this time in an injector vial, a small data slate. At the moment of death, which of these things had he been reaching for? The knife? Too slow and small to counter a man who has a naval pistol wedged into your mouth. Then again, he was desperate, and then again, he hadn't reached for his holstered las gun. The data slate, perhaps. I picked it up and activated it, but it needed a cipher to gain access. All manner of secrets might be locked inside. But why would a man reach for a data slate in the face of certain death?
"Track marks along the forearm,"
Teutrone stated, continuing her exam. Hardly surprising, given the narco wear we'd recovered from him. "No rings, no bracelets, earrings, piercing studs?"
"None."
I pulled a plastic pouch from a dispenser on the surgical cart and put all his effects into it.
"You will sign for those, won't you?"
Teutrone asked, looking up. "Of course."
"You hated him, didn't you?"
Fischig said suddenly.
"What?"
He leaned back against a plinth, crossing his arms.
"You had him at your mercy, and you knew his head was full of secrets, but you emptied it with your gun. I have no compunction when it comes to killing, but I know when I'm wasting a lead. Was it rage?"
"I'm an inquisitor,"
I do not get angry.
Then what?
I had just about enough of his snide tone. You don't know how dangerous this man is. I wasn't taking chances.
He looks safe enough to me,
Fischig smirked, looking down at the body. Here's something, Teutrone called out. We all moved in. She was working on his left hand, delicately, with her finest gauge scalpels and probes, her augmented fingers darting like a seamstress. The index finger of the left hand. There's unusual lividity and swelling. She played a small scanner across it. The nail ceramite. Artificial. An implant. What's inside?
Unknown. A ghost reading. There's maybe... Ah, there it is. A catch under the quick. You'll need something small to trigger it.
She adjusted her bionic finger settings and slid out a very thin metal probe. Thin like... a toothpick.
Back! Back now! I yelled.
It was too late. Teutrone had undone the catch. The false nail sprang back, and something flew out of the cavity in the fingertip. A silver worm, like a thread of necklace chain, flashed through the air.
Where did it go?
I don't know, I said, pushing Teutrone and Amos behind me. Did you see it? Asked Fischig.
Over there,
he said, pulling a short-nosed, gloss-black auto-pistol out from his robes. I reached for my own gun, then remembered I'd given it back to Vibben. I snatched up a bone knife from the trolley. The worm slithered back into the light. It was a metre long and several centimetres thick now. What foul sorcery had caused that expansion, I did not want to know. It was made of segmented metal, and the head was an eyeless cone split by a hissing mouth full of razor teeth. Teutrone cried out as it flew at us. I pushed her down, and the thing whipped across over us, hitting a corpse on a nearby plinth. There was a dreadful sucking, gnawing sound, and the worm disappeared into the corpse's torso through a jagged hole. The corpse vibrated and ruptured, filling the air with a foul mist of vapour. The worm swished up out of it and disappeared across the floor. By then, Fischig had opened fire and blasted the shattered corpse off its plinth. The worm was long since gone.
Touch activated mechanism,
Amos was murmuring to himself.
Very discreet, probably of Xenos manufacture, a guard weapon with some mass-altering system that expands it on contact with air and or release, hunting by sound.
So shut up, I told him. I bundled him and Teutrone against the far wall. Fischig and I moved in parallel courses down through the plinth rows, weapons ready. It reappeared. By the time I saw it, it was almost on me, thrashing forward through the air on its metallic tail. In a split second, I reflected that this was how Eiklone had wanted me to die. This was what he had intended to unleash against me on the landing platform at Processional 212. Rage made me deny him. I stabbed out, and my extended blade jabbed directly between the gaping teeth and down the gullet. The impact knocked me back. I found I had the whole heavy 2-meter thing thrashing on the end of my knife like a lash. Shots banged past me. Fischig was trying to hit it. You'll kill me, you idiot! Hold it still! With a metallic rasping, it was chewing down the blade and the handle towards my hand. Teutrone came in from behind me, and together we wrestled the powerful, coiling thing onto a plinth. She activated a bone saw on her augmetic hand and sliced down through its neck with a shrill scream of spinning blades. The body continued to thrash. She grabbed it and dropped it into an acid trough usually reserved for bio-waste. The hissing head and the knife it was still chewing away at quickly followed it. The four of us gazed down at the thrashing remains as they disintegrated. I looked round at Mortress, Teutrone, and Fischig.
I know which one of you I'd rather have around in a fight, I muttered.
Teutrone laughed. Fischig didn't.
What was it?
Amos asked me as we raced in Fischig's landspeeder through the streets to the Arbites headquarters.
You guessed more than I know, I replied. A gift from his masters, certainly.
What manner of masters makes a thing like that?
Powerful ones, Amos. The worst kind.
Our meeting at the Arbites' grim chambers was brief. At my request, Fischig had summoned Magus Palastomes, the head of the cryogenerator Technomagi. He took one look at the casket in the evidence room and said,
I have no idea what that is.
Thank you. That will be all, I told him. I turned to Fischig. Have this sent immediately to my vessel.
It is state's evidence, he began.
Who do you work for, Fishig?
The Emperor.
Then pretend I'm him, and you won't be far wrong.
Do it!
Hayden Bonds was waiting for us in the interrogation room. He had been stripped naked, but Fishig assured me nothing of import had been found in his clothes. Bonds was the gunman I had laid out in the cryogenerator chamber, the only one of Eichlone's men to have survived the night. His mouth was swollen from my blow. He had admitted nothing except his name. Fishig, Amos, and I entered the room, a dull stone box. Bonds was shackled to a metal chair and looked terrified. So should he, I thought.
Tell me about Merdin Eichlone, I said.
Who?
The darkness had gone from his eyes now. Eichlone's spell broken. He was bewildered and confused.
Then tell me the last thing you remember.
I was on Thracian Primaris. That was my home. I was a stevedore in the docks. I remember going to a bar with a friend. That is all.
The friend?
A dockmaster called Wyn Edon. We got drunk, I think.
Did Edon mention an Eichlone?
No. Look, where am I? These bastards won't say. What am I supposed to have done?
I smiled. You tried to kill me for a start.
You?
I'm an Imperial Inquisitor. At that, terror made him lose control of his body functions. He began pleading, begging, telling us all sorts of misdemeanors, none of which mattered. I knew from the first moments that he was useless. Just a mesmerized slave, chosen for his muscle, knowing nothing. But we spent 2 hours with him anyway. Fishig slowly turned a wall dial near the door that vented in increasing measures of the sub-zero air outside the sun dome. In our heat gowns, we asked questions over and again. When Bonds's flesh began to adhere to the metal chair, we knew there was nothing more.
"Warm him up and feed him well," Fishig told his men as we left the cell. "We execute him at dawn."
I didn't ask if that meant some arbitrary time in the next cycle, or real dawn, 6 months away, at the start of thaw. I didn't much care. Fishig left us to our own devices for a while, and I ate lunch with Amos at a public bistro almost directly under the sun dome. The food was sour, rehashed from freeze-dried consumables, but at least it was hot. Fountain banks projected walls of water around the edges of the bistro so that the sun globe light made rainbows that crisscrossed the tables and aisles. On this somber day of mourning, there were no other diners present. Amos was in good spirits. He chatted away, making connections I hadn't begun to see. For all his faults, he possessed a superb mind. Every hour I spent with him, I learned more techniques. He was forking up fish and rice and reviewing his data slate.
"Let's look at the transmission lag that Loing detected in the messages Eichlone sent and received while on the planet."
"They're all in cipher. Loing hasn't unlocked them yet."
"Yes, yes, but look at the lag. This one, 8 seconds. That's from a ship in orbit. And the time frame matches that period in which we know Eichlone's mysterious starship was here. But this, during your struggle with him last night, a lag of 12.5 minutes. That's from another system."
I stopped trying to macerate a lump of meat that resembled a slug and peered over. I'd never much considered the blurry sidebar that edged all astropathic message forms before. 12.5. You're sure?
I had Loink check.
So that gives us a reference frame. He smiled. Pleased. I was pleased.
3 worlds in the picture, all between 11 and 15 minutes lag of here. Thracian Primaris, Cobalt II, and Gudrun.
Thracian Primaris was no surprise. That had been our last port of call, our last sighting of Eichlone. And as far as we knew from the wretched Bonds, the place where he had recruited some or all of his servants.
"Cobalt's a nothing," I checked. "Just an Imperial watch station, but Gudrun."
"A primary trade world. Old culture, old families."
"Old poisons,"
he finished with a laugh, completing the proverb. I dabbed my mouth with a napkin. "Can we be more certain?"
"Loing's researching for me. Once we break the cipher,
I don't mean the message cipher itself. I mean the coded headers to the actual text. We'll know.
Gudrun, I pondered. My Voxlink chimed in my ear. It was Betancourt.
Ever hear of a thing called the Pontius?
No, why?
I haven't either, but Loing's cracking some of the old transcripts. In the weeks before Eichlone arrived, someone was sending messages off the approved links to a location in the Sundome. They talk about the delivery of the Pontius. It's all rather vague and indirect.
Do you have a location?
Why else do you employ us? Thorview 12011, on the west side of the dome. The high-rent quarter. Aristo turf.
Any names?
No, they're very exclusive and coy about such things.
We're on it. Amos and I rose from the table. We turned to find Fischig standing there. He was wearing the full flak armor, carapace, and visored helm of an Arbetes now. I have to admit the effect was impressive.
Going somewhere without me, Inquisitor?
Going to find you, actually. Take us to Thorview.